Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an overview of the roiling Middle East and examine how Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu is not just making President Obama and Secretary Kerry look impotent, he is also inflaming the region and making life difficult for Americans still stuck in the region, in particular in the Green Zone in Baghdad, that could soon be overrun by radicals from the so-called Islamic State. Graham Fuller, the former vice chair of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA, joins us to discuss the growing anger and frustration among the young in the region as the killing in Gaza continues in spite of appeals for humanity from the UN, and the growing territorial gains and swelling ranks of radical movements like the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. Then we'll speak with Tyson Slocum, the Research Director for Public Citizen's Energy Program, about the campaign Public Citizen has launched against Murray Energy Corporation, a privately owned coal company that is suing the government to stop federal clean air standards and protection for miners, as well as suing the EPA to stop efforts to cut carbon pollution from existing power plants. We'll discuss the so-called war on coal in important electoral battlegrounds and the power of the coal lobby in fighting environmental rules, even as there is a shift underway from coal to natural gas in generating electricity. Then finally, as record amounts of money pour into attack ads early in the midterm elections, with the Koch brothers funded Americans for Prosperity taking the lead in the Senate races with $44 million spent so far to make Mitch McConnell the majority leader in November, we will talk with Daniel Shulman, a senior editor in the Washington Bureau of Mother Jones and a founding member of the magazine's investigative journalism team. We will look into the most powerful players in American politics and discuss Daniel Shulman's latest book, just out, Sons of Wichita, How the Koch Brothers Became America's Most Powerful and Private Dynasty. Joining us now is Graham Fuller, the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for more than two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future of Political Islam, A World Without Islam, Three Truths and a Lie, and his latest, Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Graham Fuller.
Thank you, Ian.
And it seems that given the problems that the U.S. is trying to deal with in the Middle East, and clearly things are not going well in Iraq, in Syria, in Libya, in Afghanistan, and in Egypt, it doesn't seem like a particularly good time for both Obama and Kerry to be burdened further by the actions of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The idea that he's killing a bunch of Palestinian civilians in front of the entire world has got to be inflaming the Arab world. And, of course, the Arab world, the Arab street, is largely young, unemployed, disgusted with their own governments. They feel that they're too much already in America's pocket. They're not represented. Isn't this an explosive cocktail out there? And it does feel like Netanyahu's pouring gasoline on the fire.
Well, exactly, it does. I think that Netanyahu may be calculating that this is perhaps a time to further advance Israeli control over greater both the politics and the territory of Gaza and the West Bank. But yes, you're right. I mean, I've been watching this area a long time. So many things going on that could, in the end, amount to a perfect wave. I think those of us who have been working in the Middle East for so long, well before 9/11, knew that huge dissatisfaction was growing in the region consistently, and that someday, somehow, something bad would happen, but nobody could have possibly guessed that it would have been exactly 9/11. But I have that same presentiment now, because I think we see U.S. position now crumbling in Libya and in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and then Netanyahu not following any kind of American suggestions on Israel. So I fear that things can get a great deal worse, if that's possible, with possibly riots and, you know, a greater recruiting, more opportunities for the real jihadis to start recruiting young people, as you say.
Well, it may be in the next week or so that IS, as they now call themselves, Islamic State, in central and western Iraq, they're on the outskirts of Baghdad, there's not a lot left to stop them from taking the city and taking the green zone. And then we may have a really difficult situation on our hands with, I think, thousands of U.S. personnel in that green zone having to be evacuated. And again, the people that's going to be attacking them are being stirred up by our closest ally. Not that I'm blaming Israel for ISIS, but it seems to me that at a moment when you're trying to stop the spread of radicalism amongst the youth in the Middle East, if you start killing innocent civilians and we're siding with the people who are killing innocent civilians, we don't have a lot of credibility, do we?
No, we don't. Virtually every single ruler in the Arab world is there under non-democratic basis and has been in the past supported directly or indirectly by the United States, and is very careful not to go beyond lines that the United States has set for its foreign policy guidelines. So I'm afraid this is something that is yet waiting to happen. In other words, as we see perhaps Arab Spring 2, and that's certain to come because Arab Spring 1 was largely reversed in its first manifestation, if we have an Arab Spring 2, then we will see the full force of public opinion, which has been frustrated for so long by their governments that have not followed any of the wishes or desires or ambitions or emotions even of the local publics. They will suddenly become more empowered, and you could find an Arab world immensely hostile, much more hostile than today, where at least the situation is cushioned by pro-American dictators.
Well, we have this odd situation in the Middle East now where the Arab ruling families, the monarchs as well as the Assad's ruling families, the generals as in Sisi in Cairo, and the Israelis are all on the same side, in effect, against the fundamentalists.
Well, that's right. And this is where I think both Saudis and the Egyptian governments are weakening and damaging delegitimizing their own governments by walking somewhat in lockstep with Israel, which for multiple reasons is viewed as the enemy in the region now. And cooperation with Israel at this point does not do anything for endearing those governments to their own populations. And meanwhile, the U.S. is stuck because Saudi Arabia, as we know, is one of the key forces, and some other Gulf monies as well, key forces that have supported forces like IS and other jihadi groups in the area that has empowered them, and I think contributing very heavily to the sectarian war that we see underway in Syria and Iraq.
But when you were saying earlier, Graham Fuller, how these leaders that we support are seen to be too much under the influence of the Americans, and nothing could be more, and in this case, both the U.S. and Israel, couldn't be more the case with Abbas and the PA, the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. Their own people are extremely upset. My understanding is that there's a swelling rage there amongst the ranks of young Palestinians who are watching their fellow Palestinians being bombed in Gaza, and their own government is in effect, you know, a puppet, if you will, of both America and of Israel. And I can't see that thing. In fact, the former head of Shin Bet has said this is an explosion waiting to happen.
Absolutely. I think, ironically, whatever we may think of Israel's policies, a lot of its senior officials, and especially those who have retired from government, I think understand and speak fairly openly about the realities of the area. So it's the confluence of all of these things, the Sunni radical, extreme radicalism in the case of IS, and the sectarian wars that are underway in the Palestinian situation, and the U.S. essentially now retreating from Afghanistan. I think it's not going to be long before that policy will then be seen as a total debacle, and the Taliban emerging as the primary, if not if not necessarily the fully dictatorial force, but a major force in any new government, which is not what the U.S. wanted or went to war for. So I'm very concerned with this, and I think Israelis themselves have to start thinking a little more carefully about the implications of these policies. I know that we all, those of us in the West, are well aware of many Israeli liberal thinkers who are marvelous humanitarian individuals, but the more we read about what's going on now in Israeli society, the more we see this kind of siege mentality developing, extreme racism against Arabs, a sense that what the West thinks doesn't really matter anymore. This, I think, is contributing to Israel's further isolation. Perhaps American support, and Americans are generally not well informed about this issue because the press doesn't dare publish very many things that are critical of Israel. But I think the support of America and American public in general may be lulling the Israelis into not fully understanding the sea change, I think, taking place in attitudes towards Israel in most of the rest of the world.
So it does seem, though, that Prime Minister Netanyahu is doubling down, just like Vladimir Putin is doubling down. You know, the more outrage there is in the rest of the world, the more obdurate it appears, at least both of these leaders are becoming. But particularly in terms of Netanyahu, he's more or less promising the Israeli people now in a speech on Monday that he's going to settle this problem once and for all. So what does that mean? I mean, you know...
Well, the term final solution, as we know, has a hideous history and a hideous background in Jewish history. It was the expression of the Nazis and the Holocaust in Germany during World War II. So I don't know what kind of final solution you can have. You can destroy, I would argue, most of the present Hamas leadership, and there will simply be plenty of new recruits to fill in the ranks, because this is reflective of what most Palestinians think and what they're aspiring for, some kind of state and the dignity and power that would accrue to a state. I think it's clear enough from looking at Hamas rhetoric that and people who know Hamas, including in Israel, don't really believe that this is a process of throwing Jews into the sea, but rather having a strong and dignified Palestinian state alongside. I know there's rhetoric on both sides, extremist rhetoric, but that's, I think, more the reality of it.
But the other reality for American politics is that Netanyahu is making both Obama and Kerry look, you know, impotent in effect. I know there's not a lot.
That's been going on for some time, as you know. I mean, we've looked impotent in Iraq and now in Afghanistan. We've really had to back down to a more realistic position with Iran. But ironically, you know, on the one hand, if you're a neoconservative or conservative in the United States, you may say this is all a debacle because we're not standing up and being strong. And we're not fighting all these trends, but I think most others would say we cannot fight these trends. These are particular forces of history, and especially anti-imperial forces, that are now coming to the fore after a very long time. And in fact, the reality is that the United States must recognize that it cannot determine the future of Afghanistan or Iraq or even Palestine and Israel. Or any of these other places where we've been in Syria, where we've been engaged. And that I think will be the beginning of wisdom rather than the beginning of American collapse of policy.
So would it therefore mean, Graham Fuller, that if Israel, I don't know what exactly Netanyahu has in mind, how he can finally deal with the Palestinian issue once and for all, but assuming it, as many have said, this will end up being another case of mowing the lawn, that you'll be back to the status quo ante, will that then be more sobering for the... I mean, what you just said should be, I think, good advice to our government, but at some point or other, are these impulses on the part of the Israeli right, who really are in ascendancy, and they seem to be dominating the politics, and there's virtually no evidence of an Israeli left and much of a peace movement left. Do you think there's a learning curve possible in Israel? In other words, at some point or other, they're going to decide, well, we can't fight it. We might as well try and learn to live in the neighborhood.
Ultimately, that has to happen if Israel is to survive. But what will it take to bring that to the forefront in Israeli thinking? Certainly, as you say, there's no hint of that in the rhetoric of Netanyahu, much less other right-wing parties, and the shift of the entire public mood in Israel to the right now over well over a decade. So when we talk about what Israel might do by way of a final solution, permanent solution, let's face it. I mean, I think the right in Israel, Netanyahu and certainly included, their long aspiration is not a peace settlement. Their long aspiration is to simply acquire all the land of former Palestine and deal with the Palestinians appropriately. I think the hope was that if life is unpleasant enough, brutal enough, or impoverished enough for Palestinians, that they'll ultimately give up and leave. But anybody who knows the region and knows the attachment of people to land knows that that's not going to happen. So I think Palestinians will stay, will fight, and it's simply going to grow more explosive. But I don't know what, I think the only thing that will change Israel's minds is not action in the U.S. again that will toughen against Israel. I don't see that happening, especially in Congress. But I think actions by European powers, Germany, that's been very cautious towards Israel over since World War II, France, other European countries, most of the countries of the world may begin now to pursue policies, sanctions or whatever, that will bring home the truth to the Israeli government and public that this simply cannot stand and is rapidly running out of credibility and steam.
And meanwhile, in closing, Graham Fuller, I imagine in this election year, there'll be a lot more of this testosterone-driven criticism on the right against Obama and Kerry for being impotent and not going to war. I mean, I think that's all but inevitable, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, you can argue that he's impotent. We just were talking about this. You can argue that he's been impotent, but you can also argue that he's simply slowly folded in the face of reality that any rational observer of the area sees, that there are simply things we cannot and will not be able to do and cannot afford to do and cannot afford to be in a permanent state of war against most of the Muslim world, which continues in some sense and is leading to ever greater radicalization. Just when we thought that the area couldn't become more radical, it continues to become more radicalized, and that's scary.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Graham Fuller.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Graham Fuller, who's a former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future of Political Islam, A World Without Islam, Three Truths and a Lie, and his latest, Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back discussing an ad campaign exposing the lies of what might be the worst company in America.
Handful of senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Tyson Slocum, the Research Director for Public Citizens Energy Program, where he works to promote stronger regulation of energy markets, examines the impact of mergers and lax regulations over electricity, petroleum and natural gas, and monitors federal legislation on energy issues. He conducts extensive research on the influence of corporate special interests on our political system and works to promote corporate and government accountability. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tyson Slocum.
Oh, it's great to be here, Ian.
And you have, or Public Citizen, have come up with a hard-hitting radio ad that's going to be against the Murray Energy Corporation, which is a privately owned coal mining company with 3,000 employees and 8 underground and surface coal mines in the U.S., operating in Ohio, Pennsylvania, Kentucky, Illinois, West Virginia, and Utah. And some of our listeners may remember some time back there was a tragedy in Utah, and that was a Murray Energy mine that this avuncular character Murray was trying to downplay. But what was not made clear at the time was how reckless and dangerous it was to even go into this mine that had already been essentially It was a pretty much a closed mine that he'd reopened just to scavenge the last bits of it, and it was in highly, highly dangerous environment, and a whole bunch of miners died. And for a while, the press were quite sympathetic to this guy, which I found extraordinary because he's quite a character, but in the worst possible sense, because he clearly doesn't give a damn about his employees. So I'm glad to see somebody's actually taking this character on. But this is in a larger fight, surely, Tyson, in this election year, this midterm election year, where these key coal states of Ohio, Kentucky, West Virginia are very much up for grabs. And, you know, you've got this whole propaganda machine on the other side, the Republican side, talking about the war on coal.
Right. We were just kind of disgusted by the antics of a politically motivated company that was helping to fund a distortion campaign, telling misinformation about the Environmental Protection Agency's Supreme Court-mandated requirement to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. And so we felt it was important to set the record straight. Murray Energy has been putting out ads and filing lawsuits, attacking the EPA, claiming that regulating greenhouse gas emissions to deal with climate change is a declaration of war against coal, and that's absolutely false. What we have to remember is that coal production has never been higher in the United States than it is in 2014. That the coal mining industry is distracting from trends going on in the coal mining industry where there's been a shift in employment away from some high labor-intensive mines on the East Coast towards more production in less labor-intensive mines out West. And so these mining companies are coming out with lies about the EPA to try and protect themselves from issues with their own business model. And in fact, the CEO of Murray Energy very famously, just after the 2012 election, laid off almost 200 workers, blaming the reelection of Obama, and just days before had sent $100,000 check to Karl Rove's American Crossroads political attack company. So here's a CEO that has no problem spending a lot of money on political attack ads while we're failing to cover expenses for his workers. And so we took out a very modest ad. We were spending about $14,000 to set the record straight on Murray Energy, their poor environmental and worker safety record, and setting up the truth here that we can tackle climate change, and that isn't anti-worker or anti-union, but Murray Energy is an anti-union shop. And we feel that we need to talk about the types of good-paying green jobs that we can get in a clean, sustainable economy.
And Murray Energy is suing the government to stop the federal clean air standards and protection for miners from coal dust, as well as suing the EPA to stop efforts to cut carbon pollution from existing power plants. What kind of chances does he have? I mean, is he slowing things up? Is he gumming up the works? Or is he grandstanding?
Yeah, these lawsuits, neither one has a chance. On the black lung and coal ash cases, the EPA bent over backwards to put together very modest standards, and his suit isn't going to be successful. And his suit that he filed in June against the EPA on the greenhouse gas emission rule is also going to fall short. The fact is that the EPA has a winning streak now of like 9 straight cases that they've won. So, again, we have to remember that the current agenda of the EPA on greenhouse gas emissions, it's all mandated by the 2007 Supreme Court decision in Massachusetts versus EPA, where the court said the EPA must regulate greenhouse gas emissions. This is not an elective activity. It is a Supreme Court mandate.
So, Tyson Slocum, again, the Research Director for Public Citizens Energy Program, where he works to promote stronger regulation of energy markets, examines the impact of mergers and lax regulations over electricity, petroleum, and natural gas, and monitors federal legislation on energy issues. And we're talking about a pushback against this powerful sort of one-man energy company, Murray Energy. But just to go to the political problem situation again, Tyson Slocum, this war on coal that they've ginned up, it's definitely working, isn't it, for the Republicans? I mean, Mitch McConnell is beating the drum on it. West Virginia, there's a key Senate race in there as well. And, of course, Ohio is an important swing state. So is he just, if they're making this stuff up to cover the fact that they're actually pulling out of these coal states and moving west where it's cheaper to extract the coal and less labor intensive, they're nevertheless using this idea that the Obama administration is putting miners out of work, right? Isn't that's the game they're playing?
Right. I mean, mining employment peaked in 1923 in the Harding administration. So if you want to say that there's been a war declared on coal, it started with Warren Harding. Okay, the fact of the matter is the enemy of coal here is progress in technology. Right now, about 15 years ago, coal power was the fuel for about 60% of our electricity. Now, today, it's 38%. That's not because of Obama administration. That's not because of the EPA. It's because natural gas is now cheaper and renewables and energy efficiency are cheaper. And so what worked 100 years ago isn't always going to continue working. It's like saying a bunch of typewriter companies got together and pressured Congress to stop the war on typewriters in the 1990s. The fact of the matter is that typewriters went away not because of government regulation, but because they were eclipsed by competing superior technology. And that's what's going on with the coal industry. But rather admit that to the communities in which they've operated for generations, to their shareholders, they'd rather say, you know what, we have to close this mine or our profits are down in this mine because of the Obama administration, not because we have failed to adapt a business model that is changing with the economy and with improvements in technology in the energy sector. And that's exactly what's going on. Solar power is now cheaper than natural gas and coal. The city of Austin, Texas, just signed a 20-year power purchase agreement for a 150-megawatt solar facility being built in West Texas at 4.9 cents a kilowatt hour. That's cheaper than what the people of Austin are paying for their current electricity from coal and from natural gas. Solar power is cheaper than natural gas and coal. That's technology. We are continuing to compete and evolve on this, and you've got entrenched industries that are flexing their political muscle because they see that the status quo is changing, and the change in the status quo is bad for Murray Energy, but it's fantastic for the rest of us and for the planet. And so we have to be sensitive about the impacts on transition in communities, especially in communities that for three or four generations have depended on coal mining. I want to see more investment in these communities. I want to see us building and manufacturing solar panels in these communities. So I want real solutions for all people in this country. But the fact of the matter is Murray Energy should not be trying to set energy policy for the United States, because it is a backwards-looking technology, and we have to look forwards.
Now, didn't Murray Energy put on that display for Mitt Romney in the 2012 election, where he had a bunch of sort of surly miners as a backdrop? They were forced to stand next to Mitt Romney because otherwise their pay would be docked by Murray Energy. Is that the
actually, their pay was docked. They were required to attend this rally, and because the rally occurred on the mining site, they closed the mine for the day, and so all of the workers were required to show up, and they were not paid for doing so. That's all been reported by mainstream press, and so this is the kind of guy that he is. Murray Energy has given millions of dollars in campaign contributions, 99.5% of those contributions have gone to Republicans. This is a highly partisan CEO, and he has no qualms with forcing his workers to be used as props for political rallies that he then doesn't even pay them, right? That's the kind of boss this guy is. And so we just wanted to highlight this hypocrisy. You know, he's been running ads, he's been filing lawsuits, and we thought, you know what, we're just going to run some ads in the town where the company is located, and in Pennsylvania as well, to kind of hit back a little bit.
Well, let's play the ad that you have that's playing in Clairsville, Ohio, which is the company headquarters of Murray Energy, as well as on KDKA AM, which is the number one rated radio station in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Let's go to the ad now.
Imagine you're a coal miner waiting in your doctor's office. Your doctor comes in and shows you a scan of your lung. You have pneumoconiosis, black lung disease. Black lung can harden your lungs, shorten your breath. It can even cause cancer and death, and there's no cure. Safety standards can reduce the dangerous coal dust that causes black lung. But recently, a coal company named Murray Energy sued to stop these protections against dangerous coal dust from going into effect. Now, Murray Energy is also suing to block new clean air standards that would protect everyone from air pollution, including children and seniors with asthma. Murray is using scare tactics and ignoring the science, and that's just wrong. No one wants to worry about the air they breathe. Please visit citizen.org, sign the petition, and speak out now to protect our family's health and our kids' future. Message brought to you by Public Citizen.
So, Tyson Slocum, the ad clearly makes the point. What is the feeling, though, amongst people that are being put out of work in terms of are they being beguiled by Murray Energy propaganda, and are they buying his line, or are they being more reasonable and open minded and recognizing that changing technology, the rise of natural gas for electrical generating, etc., and the move of this company to greener pastures in the West is really why they're unemployed.
Right. So far, we've been hearing positive feedback. I think that, you know, look, these are still tough economic times. There are tens of millions of honest, hardworking families that are really struggling to make ends meet. And Public Citizen, as a consumer advocacy group, is really fully aware of that, of these struggles. And so I think that's why we're running this ad in these mining communities, because we want to start a dialogue. We want to say, listen, a lot of you have depended on the coal mining industry. It has served this country well, but now we've got to recognize that the environmental, the climate, and the worker health impacts are really great. They're huge, and they've had big impacts, and we've got cheaper alternatives that if we just give them a chance in the marketplace, they're going to win and they're going to deliver value for people. And let's figure out a transition path where we can get folks employed in more sustainable technologies. Let's create economic opportunity and value in these communities, and let's have an economic growth plan. That's why we teamed up with the utility workers, who are workers that work at a lot of coal-fired power plants, on a national worker transition fund that Public Citizen has endorsed. We work with the utility workers on this. Let us work with the mine workers and with mining communities on delivering direct federal grants for worker training and for manufacturing placement in these communities, because it's really important for us here at Public Citizen that all of America move forward with economic opportunity. And we have to be honest with ourselves that coal created a lot of jobs for us over the years, and it's not the economic path forward for prosperity. We have to understand that renewable energy and investments in energy efficiency are what we need to do to be a competitive a powerhouse in the 21st century. And we want the coal country to help us lead.
But just in closing, Murray Energy is a non-union coal company, though, isn't it?
They just took on some union workers in 2013 with their acquisition of Consol Energy. But prior to that, they were a non-union company. That's correct.
Well, I wish you luck with your ad and your ad campaign in coal country to get some truth in there. This guy sounds, I've sort of followed him, and I know he's the kind of epitome of the worst kind of boss. You know, he makes capitalists, look by comparison as humanitarians. He's so ruthless and swashbuckling and has such thoroughness.
Yeah, we don't take out many ads, but we were disgusted by some of his public statements and by ads and lawsuits he was filing, and we thought it was important to stand up to him, and so that's what we're doing.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Tyson Slocum.
Always my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Tyson Slocum, who's the Research Director for Public Citizens Energy Program, where he works to promote stronger regulation of energy markets, examines the impact of mergers and lax regulations over electricity, petroleum, and natural gas, and monitors federal legislation on energy issues. He conducts extensive research on the influence of corporate special interests on our political system and works to promote corporate and government accountability. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about the Sons of Wichita, how the Koch brothers became America's most powerful and private dynasty. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Daniel Shulman, who's a senior editor at the Washington Bureau of Mother Jones and a founding member of the magazine's investigative journalism team. His work has appeared in the Boston Globe magazine, Columbia Journalism Review, Psychology Today, Village Voice, and many other publications. His latest book just out is Sons of Wichita, How the Koch Brothers Became America's Most Powerful and Private Dynasty. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Shulman.
Thank you, Ian.
And Monday's New York Times has a lead article doing an inventory of how much money is pouring in to the midterm races. They expect at least $2 billion to be spent on television, breaking an all-time record, up 70% from the 2010 midterms. And the biggest spenders so far are Americans for Prosperity, which, of course, is backed by Charles and David Koch. They're spending $44 million. They've spent $44 million on House and Senate races so far, And the Senate Majority PAC, supporting Democratic Senate candidates, has spent half of that, $22 million. So clearly, based upon the reporting from Lauren Windsor, who somehow managed to get into the Big Koch Brothers confab down here in Orange County recently, where they had something like 100 billionaires gathering in secret to pledge unlimited funds to take the Senate for the Republicans and the White House away from Hillary Clinton. I guess this is a long-winded way of saying, Daniel, that your book is extremely important and very timely.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
And what's your sense then of whether already the most influential two individuals in American politics are going to become even more influential? That's the way it seems.
Well, it certainly, you know, after the 2012 election, which was kind of a failure for the Koch brothers and their allies, you know, about $400 million was spent trying to change the balance of power in that election, and it didn't really get them much. So right now what you see happening within their network is kind of a recalibration and also a sort of a doubling down. They're channeling a pretty unprecedented amount of money into the midterm elections, hundreds of millions of dollars, at least $120 million of which is going to come from Americans for Prosperity, reportedly. And AFP was really out there early hammering a lot of the vulnerable Senate Democrats. The goal in the 2014 midterms is to retake the Senate and essentially set the table for 2016. And you can certainly count on the Kochs and their allies to channel an enormous amount of money into that election. I would guess that it's going to be quite a bit over the $400 million they amassed in 2012.
Well, Daniel, in the angry mail that I get from conservative supporters of the Koch brothers, they always argue that George Soros spends more money, which is absolutely untrue. I know personally, since I formed a foundation to try and get my radio program distributed, I couldn't get near Soros. And my understanding is that Soros has given up on politics. He's more interested in what's happening in Europe, the return of the right in Europe, etc., and economic issues. But this is the problem, isn't it, that there really isn't a level playing field, that in spite of the canards that there's as much liberal money out there as there is conservative money, the truth of the matter is there seems to be almost an unlimited supply of conservative money.
Well, one thing I think that gets conflated in this whole, you know, George Soros versus the Koch brothers question is how much the brothers themselves are spending on politics. Now, what's unique about them is they have an enormous network of funders. It's not just them. You know, it's a few hundred high net worth individuals. And you have the Kochs and their political operatives that are essentially controlling this kitty of cash that they channel through any number of nonprofit organizations, some with closer ties to the Kochs than others. So that is what's unique about them. And the Democrats, you know, there's a huge amount of money on the Democratic side. There's absolutely no question about that. They've got their own fundraising network through the Democracy Alliance. But, you know, the Democratic donors are a little bit more disorganized, in my view, and they're much more single issue. George Soros, of course, has been a major political player in the past, especially in the 2004 election. But I just don't see his effort as being on the same scale as the Kochs.
Well, there seems to be a difference there between very conservative right-wing philanthropists and liberal philanthropists. The conservatives just seem to, you know, they're not interested in the minutiae of ideology and dogma. They just want to get the job done. They're really practical guys. Many of them have made a fortune as businessmen. And on the other side, just based on my anecdotal dealings, that the liberal philanthropists are, it's an endless seduction that goes nowhere because they're always very sort of self-righteous about the causes they're in as opposed to more practical. I guess in short, I'm saying the liberals seem to be self-righteous, but whereas the Republicans and conservatives are much more practical. They just want to win.
For instance, you see in terms of the Democracy Alliance, you see them coalescing around such issues as campaign finance reform. So they're raising a lot of money to push an issue like that. So there's a difference.
So turning to the Koch brothers and your book about them, Daniel, Sons of Wichita, the father, of course, is an extremely interesting character, one of the founders of the John Birch Society. I wasn't aware that he really invented a new way of refining oil, and then he came up against the cartel, Standard Oil, the Rockefellers. And ironically, the first place he could get work with his new invention was in the Soviet Union, in Stalin's Soviet Union, where, of course, he got a first-hand look at the very worst of communism.
Oh, yeah, and that's really what, you know, you can really trace that to where the Koch family's ideology is today. Fred Koch's business in the Soviet Union, his role there was really one of the formative experiences in his life. And what he saw there horrified him, and he vowed to do everything he could to fight the spread of communism. You know, in later in life, he would become quite paranoid about the depth of the Soviet infiltration. Along with his fellow Birch Society members, Fred Koch saw the specter of communism really everywhere. He believed that the communists had infiltrated, you know, the unions, and the John Birch Society were believers in the fact that the civil rights movement of that era had essentially been infiltrated by communists as well as a tool of sowing racial unrest within the country and paving the way for some sort of communist takeover.
So when he died, the father, the patriarch, when Charles Koch was in his early 30s, apparently the brothers discovered a letter from the family patriarch that said, quoting, "You will receive what now seems to be a large sum of money. It may either be a blessing or a curse." Well, it's been a curse for most of us, but a blessing for them, right?
It was kind of telling because the money in some ways ended up being a blessing to them and a curse. You know, it ended up being a blessing for obvious reasons, but it also fueled, you know, 2 decades of strife between the 4 Koch brothers as they battled each other in court over a number of things, but most prominently over the empire that their father had bequeathed to them. You know, that's one of the interesting things of this family saga. There are 4 Koch brothers. You often hear about just Charles and David Koch, but there are also Bill, who is David's fraternal twin, and Frederick, who's the eldest of the Koch brothers. And in 1980, Frederick and Bill paired off against Charles and David over control of the family company. And this extended into years and years and years of very, very bitter litigation. I mean, one of the most brutal family feuds in history. You had private investigators, you know, unleashed upon each other, digging through each other's trash, allegedly, accusations of wiretapping and buggings and things of that nature. So it got pretty brutal.
But my understanding is that the oldest, who I read somewhere, maybe it was in your book, that they were the others sort of beat up on him. He was a more sensitive, artistic guy. He sort of lives a very separate life, does he not? And sort of does up houses and collects art. And the other fellow that you mentioned, the fraternal twin of the more well-known David, he's made a multi-billion dollar fortune out of an energy company that he founded, but that's almost as much under the radar, or if not more under the radar, than the more infamous of the two brothers.
Very much so. It's Charles and David who have really gotten the most attention. As you mentioned, Frederick Koch, the eldest of the Koch brothers, he was sort of a bit marginalized from the family. Their dad was very much a John Wayne-esque figure, a man's man, and he believed in, you know, he believed in teaching his sons the benefits of really hard work, and he used to, you know, put them to work digging ditches and mucking stalls, doing all sorts of manual labor around their family compound, but also on this series of ranches that he bought in the 1940s and 1950s. Now, Frederick really gravitated more towards his mother's artistic interests, and he ended up, going to getting his master's at Yale in playwriting, and he's really been a patron of the arts. I should also note that he, his politics are really, up on the opposite end of the spectrum from his better-known brothers. He's politically liberal, but he's all these guys are very private guys, but he is, I would say, the most intensely private of all of them. And he's really spent his life restoring a series of historic homes across, around the world. And I was lucky enough to get to visit with him at one of his homes on Manhattan's Upper East Side, and just filled with jaw-dropping architecture and art. The most valuable item in his home, I think, is the gift that was given to Marie Antoinette on her wedding day, which was a canopied bed.
So did he just get some of the father's money? Because it seems like both the two most famous ones really took that, what was it, a $50 million fortune or $150 million fortune and ran it up into what they're worth, about $100 billion together, the two, Charles and David. Bill made his fortune separately, which we haven't discussed yet. But was it all the same seed money?
Yes. Well, essentially, Frederick was partially disinherited by their father shortly before his death in 1967. And the cause of this, according to Charles, was that Frederick had stolen from their father on a couple of occasions. And finally, their dad, shortly before he died, had disinherited him from his will. But previously, he'd given him, I believe, two trust funds. So he inherited slightly less stock in the family company. Now, Charles, David, and Bill all worked for the company in up until 1980 when Bill was fired. And the reason this all occurred was because he, among other reasons, there was a lot of this went back to their childhood when Bill felt like the lesser, the kind of the third wheel to Charles and David, who were quite close growing up and shared a lot of the same interests. But the other thing that happened in the 1970s was that Koch Industries came under scrutiny from a number of government regulators. At one point, felony indictments came down alleging that Koch Industries and some of its employees had essentially tried to game a federal oil lease lottery. So Bill and other shareholders in the company came to believe that Charles's anti-government philosophy sort of was influencing the direction of the company. The other thing they had objections to was the fact that Charles, who was the company's chairman and CEO, was plowing all of Koch Industries' profits back into the company. He was really obsessed with growing this company, and you can see the results of that today. But at that time, they were interested in extracting some of their wealth, they had other interests in life. And that's what ended up fueling this boardroom showdown that resulted in Bill being fired from the company. So in 1983, there's a settlement where Bill and Frederick sell back their shares in the company. In this transaction, Bill Koch receives $470 million, and I believe Frederick received $330 million.
So thus his ability to buy homes and buy Marie Antoinette's four-poster bed, etc.
Exactly, and Bill Koch would, go on to buy all sorts of, he's bought an extraordinary amount of incredible artwork himself, and he also financed a bid in 1992, a successful bid to win the America's Cup, and I think he poured, $60 million of his own fortune into that. But as you mentioned, he also created his own very successful energy company that deals in some of the same areas, actually, that Koch Industries does. One of their most lucrative areas is something called Petroleum Koch, which is essentially a coal-like fuel source. It's a refining byproduct. But this is something that's, you know, one of the most lucrative markets for this is Asia, and his company has operated pretty extensively there.
But the two most high-profile brothers, Charles and David, their Coke Industries, of course, covers so much consumer brands. You go through a supermarket, it's brawny paper towels, Dixie cups, quilted northern toilet paper, Lycra, Stainmaster carpets, Georgia-Pacific fertilizers. They've got enormous portfolio of companies. And one of the things that mystifies me is that given the normally in America, no matter how ideological a plutocrat might be, they're often cautious about their politics because, particularly if they're in the consumer business, half of their customers are Democrats and half of their customers are Republicans, and they don't want to piss off half of their customers, so they are careful about their political profile. Of course, this has changed now with this 501c4 IRS tax-exempt social welfare vehicles that they can use to hide their money and hide their names. But in short, why is it, do you think, having done this all this research on the Koch brothers, Daniel Shulman, that there's never been a consumer boycott against their products by outraged progressives and liberals who realize these guys are trying to buy our politics?
It's not for lack of trying, and I think there have been a number of calls for boycotts. I remember at one point, I'm not sure if this actually got developed, but there was discussion of creating some sort of iPhone app that you could scan the barcode of a product and it would tell you if it was made by Coke, so you would know not to buy it. You know, the thing about Coke Industries is that they really weren't in the realm of consumer products until they bought Georgia-Pacific in 2005. So with Georgia-Pacific came those brand names like Dixie Cups, like Brawny, like Angel Soft toilet paper. You know, a lot of the products that they have long provided are not ones that you could boycott. You know, we're talking about the gas that's in your gas tank. You know, things like beef, any number of petrochemicals, the equipment that's used to refine oil and other petroleum products. These are not the sort of things that consumers can boycott. Honestly, I think that people aren't necessarily aware that in their everyday lives, they are intersecting, you know, multiple times a day with Coke products, whether it's Stainmaster carpet or, you know, the plaster or wallboard in their homes, the windshields of their cars, to the electronics that's in their phones. Or any type of any manner of electronic devices. So their products are really quite ubiquitous.
Well, Daniel Shulman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Daniel Shulman, who's a senior editor in the Washington Bureau of Mother Jones and a founding member of the magazine's investigative journalism team. His work has appeared in the Boston Globe magazine, Columbia Journalism Review, Psychology Today, Village Voice, and many other publications. His latest book just out is Sons of Wichita, How the Koch Brothers Became America's Most Powerful and Private Dynasty. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.